Hey, Scott, what's that blinking thing on your hand?
I don't know. It just started on my birthday.
Yeah, I got that too recently. I mean, it's neat when I need a light, but it sucks the rest of the time.
Yeah, Sarah complains she can't sleep.
You do know what that means, don't you?
No.
It's time for your renewal.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
Uh-oh. This trippy wave shield thing is forming around us. Here we go.
Why are we lifting off the ground?
Yeah, where's that trippy music coming from?
Oh, don't worry about it. It's all part of the carousel.
I'm flying!
There's no gravity.
Renewal! Yay!
Oh, this hurts!
Thomas, this hurts! What is renewal?
Renewal's... renewal. It's renewal.
What does that mean? And why is the rotor man here? Sci-Fi Malady, Symptom 157. Logan's Run. Run, Logan, run!
Welcome back, Sci-Fi Sickies, to our continuing Give Me Sci-Fi or Give Me Death Month week. Hope you enjoyed our last week of ID4, and this week we are continuing on with Logan's Run, a movie from 1976 that stars some famous people that, if you notice, Basil Exposition from Austin Powers is the lead role in this. So, but a few notes before we go on with this film. First thing, if you have read the book or books, that's great. We have not, and we're not going to be comparing them. So do not be feel free to comment about it, but don't be surprised if we don't do the comparison. The next point we want to bring up about this is that we are deliberately, this movie is chock full of meaning. There's all sorts of layers that make Scott's sci-fi heart just giddy as all, like a little schoolgirl. And because of that, we deliberately chose not to Google anybody's meaning. We've decided to go at this on our own. We are as qualified to look for these meanings as a literary critic or, God help us, film critic, because we're not blind. We're smart too, and we don't need a film degree to. We're not going to be looking at the camera work or anything. We're going to be examining as a piece of sci-fi and the meanings therein. And we didn't want that to be colored by anybody else. So we deliberately skipped anything from Google. So if you found something, feel free to share it with us later on. But that, just note that we did that deliberately so we could get our own pure reaction.
Yeah, and if I'm wrong, allow me to quote crying wrestling fan, "It's still real to me."
Yep. As long as you don't turn into the Shockmaster.
Man, oh, please.
Best wrestling moment ever.
It's up there. It's definitely up there. It's the best wrestling blooper ever, possibly.
And how. So, the other thing before we get into any other information is that this is actually a dystopian film. Some people might be tempted to call it a utopia, and maybe the society appears that way, but without jumping into deep meanings right away, I just want to put that out there. Bear that in mind as we talk about it. This is almost a sarcastic utopian film that's hiding as a dystopia.
This is definitely a dystopian future, and it's in the same way that Demolition Man is a dystopia. It's on the trope and the common theme that utopias are really dystopias when you dig beneath the surface.
Correct. So bear that in mind as we're continuing this. And the reason we picked it for this month is because Logan is, and whatever that resistance group he runs into, that were the Ankhs, they are kind of rebelling against the society that exists as is. So that's why we picked it. So
here's my secret theory. My secret theory that only people from Northeast Ohio will understand. The whole resistance group, the whole city is actually run by Rotor Man. And that's why there's Carousel. And that's why that's the end ritual, because Rotor Man is the guy who's running the whole city behind the scenes. Now, for those of you who aren't from Ohio, I'm pretty sure Thomas should remember. Mark, I know you have to. You remember Rotor Man, right?
No.
Thomas? Mm-hmm. You do or don't?
I do. Yes.
Mark, Rotor Man.
Hang on. I'm Googling it. Maybe it'll trick my...
Anytime you went to Geauga Lake, there was a middle-aged man who stood right next to the door and never got off the rotor. He stayed on. They let him stay on it all day. He showed up at the time the park opened, and he would ride the rotor from open to close. And the rotor is just as every fair has it. It spins around really, really fast. The floor drops out, and the centrifugal force holds you to the wall. Rotor Man never left the rotor. I guess he still shows up at fairs as Rotor Man.
You know what? I do remember this now.
Yep.
He only left for bathroom breaks or maybe to eat, and then he got right back on.
Right. I'm going to go take lunch and get right back on this 100-mile-an-hour spinning merry-go-round.
Until they actually told him, you have to leave.
but they never did. Everyone else had to get back in line. Rotor Man just had an agreement.
Leave, I mean, like, the park closed.
Yeah, there was theories that he actually lived in the rotor and never left.
So how does this relate to Rotor Man, please?
It doesn't. There was Carousel, and it just made me think of Rotor Man.
Oh, okay.
And well, since Carousel is key to the whole city, it made me think secretly Rotor Man is running the city.
Oh, well, we have learned here. This was Scott's fake deep meaning. This was his pseudo fake meaning, I guess you would say.
Yep. And now you all have some local history about Northeast Ohio and the amusement park that got destroyed by Cedar Point.
Yep. So, just a few notes about this movie came out in 1976, 200 years after the American Revolution started. No connection, but, you know.
Or is there? So you gotta ask, is it possible that this movie was released 200 years after the American Revolution, taking place outside of D.C.? I think you have to ask if it was written by George Washington as a time traveler.
And by the way, it was just a few short weeks before July 4th. It was released on June 23rd.
I'm sorry, guys. I kicked David Hatcher Childress out of the studio. We can continue now.
Okay. So, thank you. June 23rd, 1976, it stars Jenny Agutter as Jessica, Michael York as Logan, who you might remember if you've ever seen Austin Powers. He was Basil Exposition. Farrah Fawcett as Holly, who was there purely for the sex appeal. Richard Jordan as Francis and Peter Ustinov as the old man.
Don't forget Roscoe Lee Brown as the voice of Box.
That's true. And funny thing about this, I just feel like I have to mention, is that the sequel name is Space Disco 1, which, as we discuss this movie, that will become extremely apparent. And allegedly, they are going to be remaking Logan's Run. Hopefully, they decide not to go all in on the 70s look, because that tends to ruin the timelessness of the story, because... when every time you think of Logan's Run, you hear John Travolta, or you hear or whatever that is, or trippy. Basically, whenever that happens, you tend to only keep it in that position in that time period. So anyway, I'm going to give the real 1 minute. Plot summary. 1 minute plot summary. Okay. Did you guys believe I can do it?
I'll see it when I.
I'll let you know how close you get to it.
I'm turning on my stopwatch now. Here we go. So, in the year 2274, human civilization has survived some kind of catastrophe and now live in geodesic dome, basically hermetically sealed utopian cities, where everything is done by robots or machines, and everyone else just lives this nice m- Metropolis-style life where they have sex and walk around. And nobody apparently has jobs except for the cops, who are called Sandmen. Because their job in this city, no one lives to past 30. They have little gems on their palms. And when they hit the time, when they hit 30, it starts flashing and they all go into something called carousel where they're renewed and recloned or something like that. And one of the guys, I've already blown it, but one of the Sandmen named Logan discovers an Ankh, and the computer sends the main city computer. He makes up procedure 03303, which is designed for them to go find where the runners go, because they've had 1,056 runners, and he is sent off to locate where the runners are going to a place called Sanctuary. And thanks to a girl he met on the wire, which is basically a big kind of Tinder with teleportation feature, he meets a lovely young lady what's her name? I forget all of a sudden.
Jessica. Jessica 6? Yes, Jessica 6.
Yeah. Yeah, they're all given numbers based on the version they are, the clone number that they are. So he's Logan 5, I think.
Yes.
So he goes with her and he starts running away from the city with his friend Francis hot on his heels. They escape out of the city with the help of this underground organization that helps runners, I guess. And they get out of the city after narrowly escaping a robot called Box, who captures everything that he can for food, including previous runners. Soylent and Green is people. They get out, see the sunlight, and they run into the remains of the old U.S. Senate chamber, where they meet an old man with cats, and they've never seen cats before. They've never seen animals. And the old man basically explains to them what happened. So Logan and Jessica wind up back in the city. I'm covering a lot of ground here. And they go back and they try to convince everyone that carousel is a lie, that renewal isn't true. And they are captured by Sandman and take to the computer and interrogates Logan. So Logan insists that there is no sanctuary and that he found an old man and that people can live past that. And so the answers Logan gives, the computer doesn't like, and it destroys itself. The city crashes and all these people are going to go outside and presumably die now. The end.
Just over 3 minutes, I believe.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This one involved more explanation. This isn't like ID4. ID4 takes 30 seconds.
It still ranks as one of your shortest summaries ever.
Awesome. So now that we got the basic facts and the plots out, let's do some of the rips and picks. And I want to start with 70s sci-fi. Is that a rip or pick? Because it looks like this was filmed in the Mall of America.
Absolutely.
Or a mall. Definitely not Mall of America.
Yeah, but any shopping mall with some 70s good vibes feeling in there. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, Thomas, you were talking about The Wire, which literally is Tinder with teleportation. You flip through the people you want, and one of them's a guy. So it's like, wow, that's kind of progressive for that era, that it gives the idea that, well, it is a hedonistic society, so do whoever you want.
Yeah, is it progressive or wasn't it progressive? Because we're showing it as the evil hedonist, so maybe it wasn't so progressive.
Maybe. I guess at that point, the progressive is the, well, you can have whoever you want, but then again, you have to remember, this is total Studio 70, or Studio, what was that place? 76 or something?
Studio 54.
Yeah, this is total Studio 54, where the only people who have jobs are the Sandmen.
I've seen this come through and say that the fact that, you know, you could dial up, you were a guy and you could dial up a guy on The Wire meant that it was progressive in terms of the LGBTQ community.
And, so it's all over the place, basically.
Yeah, but if you're looking at you could see it that way. But if you're looking at the potential interpretation of this movie, that it's showing you the dangers and the negatives of a hedonistic lifestyle, then maybe, you know, it's not so progressive in pointing that out.
Okay. So it could go either way, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting to me, too, is that this book was published in 67, right during that time of the don't trust anyone over 30. So without having read the book or the author or anything else, it just makes me think, I wonder if that factored in, you know? Like, this is why you die at 30, because don't trust anyone over 30. Maybe this is the author's way of saying, can we knock that stuff off?
Yeah, I believe that was absolutely there. There's a theory that placing this thing in the Mall of America was an anti-consumerism message as well.
Could be. But I'm just saying, it's that. But just the way they make the city look, too, even though, yes, you can tell it's a model, it's trippy looking. The music is trippy. The outfits are just, Thomas, you brought it up. Jessica, especially when she's on the wire, is wearing nothing more than a sheer poncho and some kind of string wrapped around her waist, so you get total side nudity.
Or the scene where they have to take their wet clothes off before they freeze on them, only to put them back on 5 minutes later.
Yeah, yeah.
Just enough time to show off a naked female.
Well, I mean, they also, like, when you look at the, so there's the wire where Logan literally tells Jessica, she gets there, he's like, well, let's have sex. Just more like, well, let's have dinner. And, or when they go into the, what is that, love shop or whatever?
You mean sex club?
The escape tunnel that they run through the deviant sex club?
Yeah, but what was it called in there?
Oh.
I don't know. But he, when they go in there, I assume in the book, in the novel, it's a very interesting description. Not like, you know, weird and not bad and trippy like the movie. But in the movie, it's like they slow it down, decide that the camera has to trip on acid, because everything has trails and everyone's naked and rubbing against each other. And it's just like, wow, that's okay.
Yeah, there were points in this movie that the only thing I could think of is, this is what would happen if you gave Cirque du Soleil performers acid and ecstasy and said, go perform your act.
Yeah, and then told them, and while you're at it, pretend it's 1976.
Let's be honest. Let's be 100% honest on what that was. That was the filmmaker wanting to see something and being able to go, hey, buddy, you want to be an extra? You look hot. Here's $50. Stand naked over there and rub on another woman.
Yeah, possibly. Or it was again. Or it was again
in the book, but the way they depicted it, totally what you said, Thomas.
It could have also been just an effort for, again, you can really look at this as a critique of hedonism, and that can just be a critique of strip clubs and those type of places where, you know, I mean, they walk in there and without even asking them if they want to be there, just start basically assaulting them or trying to.
Yeah, well, it's probably assumed that when you go in there, you walk in, take your clothes off, walk in, and at some point you walk out.
But there was definitely no consent. Let's put it that way. No consent.
Oh, consent is walking in the door for them, I guess.
Look, there was a lot of times in this film where, I mean, just as a general rip, I lost count of the amount of times I said out loud to Sarah, what the bleeping ecstasy, I'm sorry, what the bleeping acid trip is this?
Oh, no. I said the same. I was watching it and wifey just heard me keep going, what is this? What did, and I even texted you guys. Ah, yes. Former hippie sci-fi, where they're bringing their benders and acid trips into their filmmaking.
Well, yeah, there's not just that, but it was very much the sexist appeal. I mean,
oh, without a doubt. I mean, this is the heart of the sexual revolution.
Yeah, I mean, other than her outfit and every other girl's outfit, you have a nude sex club. You also decide at some point you have to strip your clothes off. And also, we're going to run through water with just a sheer cloth outfit at best. Nothing else underneath. I'm sure that was totally designed because it was important to the book and had nothing to do with the director wanting to see boobs.
And remember when Box, the robot Box, shows them the runners that it froze.
They were all naked.
Total full frontal nudity.
Oh, yeah. This was the 70s where you had the obligatory nude scene in every movie.
Right. So, and I mean, it's not dissimilar to now, actually. So I can't really say that's like, oh, how hedonistic were they? But given the fact that it was the sexual revolution back then, it was like Thomas said, well, we have to add it somewhere. And it was trying to show that if you had a society run by 20-somethings, allegedly run, because this is computer run, and where really nobody does anything that I can tell other than walk around, drink, have sex, and then go to carousel.
They don't have jobs. Yeah.
Yeah. What are they doing? So that's what it would be. I mean, if you took a bunch of 20-somethings and said, you don't have to work, you can just go to the gym, work out.
Sit in the hot tub.
The hot tub. Heck, they have that doctor with the Renew.
Yeah, you can change your face. Your
face. I don't want to, you know, it's kind of like Altered Carbon before Altered Carbon. And it's so weird because it's like, I'm 25 and I want to look like someone else now. But they're all clearly genetically modified to be attractive. You have to wonder, when they built this city, did they take the creme de la creme of genetic pool? Because it's not like there's any, we'll just say plain Janes in that place.
True.
So everyone is athletic, or it reminds me very much of Metropolis, where when everybody was at the top, they were attractive, well-to-do, they raced, they played games, they frolicked. There was nothing for it.
It's a weird remnant of society that it's another thing that doesn't make sense in this film with an unanswered question. It's a weird remnant of society that survived a catastrophe. It's a catastrophe that only the beautiful people survived.
Yeah, basically. And they don't really have to live in it. Or the people that are at top, they don't have to do anything.
Nobody has to do anything.
It's a weird kind of like it. We're going to get into this later, but with religious overtones, and I'm sure this was not the intent of the author. I'm adding this myself, that as a Christian, you know, I believe in a heaven, but this isn't even heaven, because it's made clear, not to turn this into the sermon series sci-fi podcast, but it's made clear in the Bible that nobody's married in heaven, but everyone is given a task. And that doesn't mean drudgery work, but like, you're going to be a musician and you're going to build furniture. I don't know. You know, the point is, there will be a purpose to life. And here, this is like the alternate of that. It's like, but you also live forever. You're in a perfect form. It's kind of like being back in the Garden of Eden, but this is a twisted version of that, because it's hedonistic and you die at 30.
I think what we're seeing,
that point, you're not really doing anything.
I think what we're seeing with this city is a critique of the materialism. I think there's a slight critique of a lot of what was going on in the 60s and 70s of this pursuit of pleasure and pursuit of wealth and pursuit of the consumerism that has become almost a secondary American religion in recent decades. We really have shifted far away from the puritanical roots of this country to become more of a hedonistic consumerism driven society. And I think this is a critique of where that runs to at its end, at least on one level.
Without a doubt, that is, the current pandemic is great evidence of that. When I hear, I think, side rant, when I hear people complaining that they can't get a latte and how it's the same as living in Nazi Germany because if they want to get a latte, they have to wear a mask because the business said put one on. It makes me think, you know, our grandparents had to survive on empty stomachs during the Depression, taking whatever work they could get.
Cabbage soup and some bread crusts.
If they were lucky. And then they went and fought in a war where rationing was the standard. Everyone was like, well, we're not getting meat tonight because we're not getting meat. And guess what? There's no nylons. And all of this is we got to win the war. We're going to have to tighten our belts.
It was, yeah, wartime production. That,
and then you come here now where someone says, where a state official says, hey, wear masks and you can't, these businesses are not actually essential because you don't need a tattoo to survive. And it's, my rights, I'm living in the Soviet Union.
I'm more sympathetic to the business owner who's put his entire life into his tattoo shop and maybe started it when he
was that guy. And, yeah. And like I said, if it was someone who was just saying, please, for the love of God, find a way to help me open so my livelihood is fine. Yeah. I'm talking about John Q. Consumer.
Right.
That's losing their cool because, nope, no latte from Starbucks today.
The person who opened up a bar 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and that's been their livelihood or they inherited from their father and it's everything they've ever put their life into, and it isn't going to survive and open up again. I sympathize with them. I understand why they're angry. I understand why they're mad. I understand why they feel their right to earn a living has been trampled. I may not agree that the right thing to do would have been to let that bar stay open, but I understand where they're coming from. Giant spike
in Ohio, the biggest spike in COVID now is between 20 and 30.
Yep. But so look, I'm not disagreeing. I say I understand where they're at. But the people who are just mad that they can't go consume, I don't have the sympathy for
that. That's exactly my point. Like I said, a guy who's really wringing his hands because his business is in danger, that's no easy answer, and I feel for you.
Yep.
The woman who's angry because she can't go into a craft store and buy a mat and buy stickers. It's like, really? That's your big concern? You can't go buy stickers today?
But I think, yeah, this movie kind of rings, you know, you see the excesses of hedonism there and you see it in our own society. And this movie kind of brings that, puts a pretty fine point on it. And I think, you know, that aspect of it, the way the city runs, the structure of the city, I think that definitely is a critique on where America was headed in the 70s and in the 60s and where they felt it was going and ultimately continued to go.
Yeah, sure. You know, before we jump into themes, is there any, like, we were in Rips and Picks, but is there anything that makes you just say that you really feel is a good thing about this film you want to mention before we jump into some of the themes we talked about before starting?
Absolutely. One of the things that I really liked about this film is when they get outside, they make sure to show you the grass is overgrown and not overgrown as if someone hasn't cut it in a week. They're showing you the grass that you see on the freeway in August that hasn't been cut and is 7 feet tall that you can walk into and disappear in. They make sure to show you and they make sure to find real on-location sets to where the grass hasn't been cut. Unlike The Walking Dead, where you're watching the whole thing going, who's cutting the grass in the zombie apocalypse? Because it's cut everywhere. I actually just kind of got struck by that as I'm walking through going, hey, here is some attention to detail. And I can actually believe this as a post-apocalyptic outskirts of DC to where everything has been overgrown and somewhat gone back to nature. I like that.
That is good. I think some point Thomas brought up when I logged on that was really neat was how everyone's just wearing sheer clothing or ponchos, except for the Sandman. They get to wear clothing.
You know, it definitely looks like Gene Roddenberry had a say in what the future was going to be, because in his version of the future, everyone wore less or spandex or one pieces. And, you know, even the Sandmen are in their one pieces.
Right. So
I liked the sound work and the score. It was done by Jerry Goldsmith. Jerry Goldsmith did a lot of work for Star Trek over the years. I think it was another fantastic piece of work The score is futuristic. It's full of 70s and 80s synthesizers and that type. It definitely hits that note. But the score puts you in the right theme for this, you know, the right mindset for this movie.
Okay. Okay. I also, for campy reasons, I like the, I guess they're laser guns. They look more like lighters that blow stuff up randomly at a distance.
Yeah, almost like a psionic screwdriver or a sonic screwdriver.
Yeah.
In a way,
yeah.
A little bit like that.
Right. And it's terrible, but it's also because of the camp. It's like, I like that. It sucks, but I like it. It's the same thing like Star Crash.
Yep. Box. Box was great.
Oh yeah, Box. I don't know what to think about that robot on roller skates. That, and who clearly has a mouth that is lips with foil taped to them. And he sounds good, but man,
he also Don from Don's malfunction.
It's like Don from Don's Breakfast Cereal walked in and went, "Whoa, guys, I think you need to update your robot."
Yeah.
I just love that he's turning everyone into human fish sticks.
But then he's also making those statements like krill and whatever he was saying, all are being frozen.
Yeah. It's like, okay, congratulations. You have a malfunctioning robot that's in charge of food, maybe?
Yeah. Well, and this whole Soylent and Green is people thing.
It brings a whole new meaning of, you guys aren't doing anything and leaving it up to robot.
Yeah. Well, and just, yeah. Box is an interesting character. And is it just me, or is the tubes they travel in, is that where Matt Groening got the idea in Futurama?
I'd have to look into it because, hey.
That could be. I mean,
yeah, it could be like one of the many things, but I just thought, oh, look, the hamster tubes, but there's cars.
Yeah. Also, that seems weird, but whatever. Are there the stations, but are there turning points then? Are there junctions?
Yeah. Well, and remember, too, there's the one, what was the place called with the wild people?
Cathedral,
where they put all the basic genetic defects in.
I.e. kids.
Yeah, well, wild people.
And kids who are being kids. Let's be honest, it's just kids.
Kinda, yeah. But it's just one of those haves and have-nots things that they chalk up.
I guess.
So I think we're at a good point to just jump into some of the themes we talked about before the show started. And I'm going to start with something Thomas threw out there that honestly, I don't know if it's true, but it's worth looking into, I think. And that's the Francis Loves Logan arc. So Thomas, what were you getting at with that?
Well, when I saw this, I kind of was thinking that he's chasing him way more than he probably should. I mean, it's your job. But the dude escaped. I mean, he chases him outside. Chases him all the way to DC. Chases him and literally seems to be against his girlfriend now because he's taking him away.
Mm-hmm.
And in the beginning, like, literally, they seem to be friends, but then there's also the bit where he's trying to get Logan into the hot tub with him.
Get in the water, yeah.
There's the whole bit with, like, bringing girls over to his house. I mean, it just seemed like he really wanted to be with Logan. Now, if I'm right or wrong, I don't know. It was just something I observed and thought it could be possible.
Okay.
I could be a sexual attraction thing. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's not I don't think it's anything necessarily addressed, but it's an interesting observation that isn't entirely unfounded. It at least makes some degree of sense. Because, yeah, it's at the end of the day, yes, Logan is the only one who has this mission and it's kept under wraps deliberately. But why is Francis so intent on following him? Because what's in it for him?
Yeah. I mean, once you get out of the city, why continue? I mean,
yeah, what do you,
a little intense.
You're endangering your life for your friend, and it could be just deep friendship. Sure, of course it could. But it could also be, as you said, romantic love. So I think we already talked about hedonism in the future a bit, unless someone else has something to add to that.
No, I think we've really hit that one.
Yeah. So let's move on to some of the religious overtones that Scott mentioned. And I'm going to tack on to something about that as far as atheism is concerned. But Scott, what were you saying about some good religious overtones?
So I thought that this movie, I can't get away from it, but I think that this movie is a critique ultimately on religion in general. And I felt it was a lot on the nose for Christianity. I can see, you know, Christianity is a religion that talks about being born again. Now, don't mistake. There's a difference between Christians, born again Christians, and the concept of being born again in Christ. But Christianity talks about that. And I think renewal, that you are renewed and born again, essentially, if you survive carousel, if you're worthy. The same way that if you are not worthy in the eyes of God, because no one is, but you can be born again in Christ and live eternally. And that's kind of, I couldn't get away from that comparison of renewal. But then I feel like it's a critique of Christianity because you've got Logan asking Francis, have you ever seen anyone actually renewed? And you can actually say, have you ever seen anyone born again? Or can you say, you know, take it outside of Christianity. There's religions that believe in reincarnation. Have you ever seen anyone actually reincarnated that you can actually verify it and you've seen it yourself, not just told that it has happened? I think it's a critique in general on religion about the concept of seeking some form of renewal of your earthly life, either in this realm or in another. And then I can't help but seeing sanctuary as another way where Jessica's subversive group is constantly searching for sanctuary, which is a way for them to live past 30, to live past their society's allotted days when life must end. Ultimately, it's all a myth. Renewal is a myth. Sanctuary is a myth. And there's a point where Jessica is saying, it has to exist. We have to find sanctuary. Sanctuary must exist. We've been told it exists. It must exist. And Logan says, it's a myth. Just because you want to believe in it doesn't mean it's real. And I can't help but wondering if that is an atheist criticism of Christianity and the belief in being born again or renewed in Christ and finding life in a heaven. You know, it's not a criticism I agree with, not a you know, meaning that I like, but I can't help but wondering if that isn't the point of one of the themes in this film is to just take a real crack at that core religious belief and almost saying that that is as dangerous as losing yourself to the hedonism and materialism and consumerism that is also a theme in this movie, that's bad too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to add something that maybe there is just a tad of cynicism about atheism as a cure, because in this, renewal is also just being recloned, reborn. And well, that's a lie. And running away, sanctuary is a lie. And so it almost ends on a note of what is going to cure us?
Maybe it's a Gnostic. So, maybe it's Gnosticism here.
Maybe. Well, again, without having read the book or knowing anything about the author, any of you sickies know, you can chime in late on the comments, but right now from where we are, maybe it is.
I think it leads to I think it leads to really being a critique that a lot of what our society tells us is the truth in many different ways, whether it's religion, whether it's material, whether it's philosophy of any kind, is a myth. And it might get to the point of even being that real truth is unknowable, or real truth is what you can see in front of you and only believe what you can see and perceive in front of you and trust your senses and not what you're told is real.
Okay.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. We're winding down here, but the next one I wanted to bring up was, we had the question, how does the society function? And I wanted to tie that in with technological overdependence, because when the seals cracked, the cities opened, and even when Logan and Jessica get out and see the sun and immediately say, what's that? They don't know anything that's outside. And there's kind of like a technological overdependence, in my opinion, because what are they doing? They have these machines or robots to do everything for them. The only people who really have jobs are the doctors who are finding out ways to plastic surgery you, and the Sandman. And everyone else seems to just be there, like rabbits walking around, eating, making love, and defecating.
Actually, this have either one of you heard of Project Utopia?
I have not.
Yes, actually. It was a Cold War thing, right?
No, not quite.
Okay.
It was more a psychological thing than Cold War. Happened during the Cold War, but yes.
Okay.
It was what they did is they took mice, tons and tons of mice, and they basically built Utopia for them. And I'm talking Utopia. Like, there was plenty of living space. Food, water was provided for them. Food and water was everywhere, abundant. So there were no hunting. There was no, killing them off, separating them, nothing.
Okay. So
the thought was that the mice were going to then all just continue repopulating until they ran out of space, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't happen that way. Because there was no threat, because there was no challenge for these mice, their society collapsed.
Oh.
The population boomed, and then it just plummeted until literally every single mouse died. There were no more mice. Not because of food, not because of water, nothing like that. Not a disease. Psychological deterioration because of nothing. Everything was provided.
It reminds me, as I was watching it,
they separated it off into like subgroups, like literally groups that didn't want to eat, didn't want to mate, and just cared about grooming themselves. Others that just fought each other. I mean, they separated into weird cliques and weird psychological twists and turns. A fascinating study.
You know, it's interesting you said that, because where I was going with this, it's a society that shouldn't function in my head. Here's the Star Trek reference for the day, but I think I already made that with Gene Roddenberry. But anyway, it reminds me of the original series episode, The Apple, where they find the Keepers of Vol. And it's a perfect, peaceful society that's imbalanced. They don't need to reproduce. They live forever in health, no violence, no crime. All they got to do is feed Vol a couple times a day. He controls the weather. They have a utopia. And Captain Kirk decides it must be destroyed because these people aren't striving. They're not struggling. They're not growing. It's a stagnant society. And he goes and he destroys their utopia, kills their god in front of them, and then says, all right, we're out of here. Figure it out.
Well, and Vol is a computer, isn't it?
Pretty much. He's a computer at the bottom of a cave that they blow up. And then, Kirk's like, we call it freedom. You're going to like it a lot, or else I'll make you like it.
Yeah. Well, that is interesting, because he also teaches them about love and romance and sex and all that. And
but he says, you just keep going the way you're going. You'll figure it out.
Yeah. I remember this episode. Now that I think about it, it's pretty twisted.
It really is.
But I mean, I also, it reminds me too, the technological overdependence. I work in a maintenance and cleaning job. It's mostly cleaning these days. And what happened was, there was a, one day, we have some teenagers, and one day someone, one of them came to me and said, "Hey, there's a toilet clogged." And I just assumed they were asking me where the plunger was. So I said, "Oh, the plunger's in the closet down the hall. It's right on the floor to the left when you walk in." And then he looked at me and said, "What do I do?" "You plunge it." And mind you, this kid's 18. Said, "You plunge the toilet." Never. Nope. Not a clue. Not a clue.
You got to be kidding me. I mean, come on now. Even modern toilets need plunged.
Show this kid how to plunge a toilet and another time change a light bulb. And I'm thinking to myself, well, with your phone, you can use that like it's nobody's business. But as soon as I take that away and say, let's do something real, total loss. That I would not be surprised. I'm not going to name the kid, but I would not be surprised if he had never mown the lawn before.
But so this seems more like a failure of his parents that never made him do any real thing in his entire life. I mean,
that is correct. I would agree with you. But
as of this point, it's not like we're asking him to figure out how to use a rotary dial phone.
Correct. Correct. But the point I'm getting at is there is currently a really big reliance and connected to technology. Think of all the parents you see out there, and I'm not knocking the strategy. I'm knocking it when you overdo it, that as soon as the kid cries, shove a tablet or a phone in their hand and let them watch it.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying you can't use it ever, but how many parents just, the kid learns at 3, 4, if I want to watch Baby Bum or whatever it is, I just cry, and then I get to play with the shiny thing.
Yeah. Well,
and I'm wondering what the long-term detriment, and I do mean detriment, is going to be.
Well, I would say I agree with you in a lot of points. I'm going to say this movie, though, has an interesting point. You don't even have mothers and fathers in this universe.
Right. Right.
You don't even have parental figures. You don't have love. You don't have that type of connection. Your life span is extremely short. I mean,
what can you learn?
You're nothing, right? And you're also not, you don't have a purpose to life. You don't live to do a job. You don't live to do anything. There's no love or purpose to life.
You're an animal.
Right. And let's be honest, when these world opened up, they were now free. They're dead. Let's be honest.
Oh, totally.
Even if a few of them survive, they're not going to make it. A, they're in a hermetically sealed environment. Disease is going to kill a good chunk of them because now they're exposed to germs again.
Yeah.
Right.
Another thing, what's food? I mean, they don't know how to farm. They don't even know anything about food.
They don't know how to fish.
Right. They're definitely not clothed.
They can't even collect nuts and berries.
Right. They don't know what to eat. Clothing-wise, they're good grief. They don't have clothing for outdoor, you know, environment. As soon as it rains, they're all screwed.
They don't have the footwear for an outdoor environment. They're going to cut their foot and get it infected and die.
Right. And then, heaven forbid they start repopulating, you better hope that enough of them survive to actually at least have some kind of genetic drift.
Right. If they're even capable of will they even know what's happening when they're pregnant?
Right. And that's also if, and I repeat the word, if the cloning process hasn't sterilized them. Because
as much sex as they have, it almost has to.
Yeah, because they're having sex. Apparently, none of them are getting pregnant. So it's
Population control. So,
yeah. This is really like a Captain Kirk thing. They just blow up the city and the whole structure of way of life, and like, oh, they'll figure it out. No, you just killed them all, Jim. But watch when Logan and Jessica are running when they stop for shelter for the night. Doesn't even know to make a fire. He just crawls inside some tree branches.
Yeah, and not to mention, we don't see a single wild animal. Wild animals we saw were cats. Let's be honest. There's probably some wolves, some, you know, former domesticated dogs that have now become, you know, wild again.
Mm-hmm.
Coyotes. Who knows what else out there?
Thank God that was the Potomac and not down south somewhere where there might be a gator in there.
Right.
Well, yeah, snakes or something like that. Yeah.
I mean, I assume honestly, that was the Potomac. It could have been another river, but.
No, well, it's pretty close to D.C., so I'd say probably
Potomac. Gotta be.
I mean, honestly, if you're living around there, there's not too many deadly things or things. But I mean,
not anymore.
Wolves, maybe, because.
Yeah.
Over time, it would have taken it back. But, like, no wild animals showed up. They're not. They can't even fight, let's be honest. I mean, they got guns, and I would question the technology the guns are at. Seem more like stormtrooper blasters, but hey.
Well, the last theme, I don't know if this is a theme, I just want to point out. With the population controls, Thanos would approve.
Yeah.
Thanos would approve.
You know, I asked this question beforehand, and, you know, we look at it as, you know, we're instinctively trained to look at Carousel and killing everyone off at 30 as if it's a terrible, evil, horrible thing. And I'm going to go on the record as saying, even after I think about it, it's still a terrible, evil, horrible thing. But I'm going to create a thought experiment here. We have a hermetically sealed geodesic dome structure. Limited space, limited resources. Box has gone crazy and he's, you know, finding all the protein from the sea that he can in people. But you have limited food. You're not farming. You probably have limited oxygen, limited power, limited resources. Maybe the most efficient way to maintain this society really is to say this is your maximum age. And at this point, this is the end of life. This is your last day. And we make room for the next generation of this society to come on board in an organized way so that we're not stuck with a case where the first wave of people who survived lived to be 60 and they all died off before there was a mature population ready to take their place. It's an interesting concept of what do you do when you really are stuck in that situation where you have an extremely finite amount of resources without the ability to go find more and push a frontier to get it. And one or two extra people could mean the difference between survival of the species and death of everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You hope you're never in that spot, but what do you do?
So,
I don't know. That is an interesting question because you are correct, but this is the other thing. Whatever created the need for this dome, either it had to, it obviously didn't wipe out every single human being outside of the dome.
No, and clearly there's no need for the dome anymore.
Right. A temporary vault would be fine, but no, you decided to retreat into a dome and literally live there and generations. Why?
Because you didn't know anything else, but
right. It's like this program.
Why wasn't it temporary? Instead, I mean, literally, this city and stuff was built up to be permanent. There was no slowing down or decreasing of this. It was like it was designed to never stop.
Mm-hmm.
It was designed that this is your population. You live this way forever.
I mean, this is the 23rd century, and I'm guessing that this was some type of atomic holocaust and a nuclear winter. And you know, I mean, yeah, you might have not known how long you would have had to survive in that dome. But apparently, civilization outside the dome definitely survived too.
Yeah, not fantastic, but it survived.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask if Scott had a deep meaning, but we got to wrap this up. Is there any final deep meaning you got, Scott?
No, I mean, I really think I hit on it earlier when I said that it's a critique of all of our societal norms and that it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's religion, whether it's a prevailing, social theory at the moment or a custom or a belief. you know, I've said it before, a lot of the reason that any society works is that because everybody believes in it. Any type of government structure, any type of societal structure, any type of organizing principle holds because people believe in the myth of that structure, or if not necessarily the myth of the structure, they believe in the structure. And as soon as you stop believing in any of the organizing principles of society, it stops working. It really does. And so maybe that's what this is saying, that, you know, it's all a myth, and it's what you choose to put your belief or your faith in that makes that organizing and controlling system work, and that society, that there is no truth at the bottom of anything. And that society runs because we choose as people on things that we will agree with or believe in, or that we're at least willing to accept their existence and let them be.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying, so it's like, you know, let's look at any government. Any government exists because the people believe that that government has power. And, you know, at any point in time, you know, any government has power because the people give it to them. It doesn't matter what form of government it is, autocratic, theocratic, democracy, republic, any of it. It exists because the people as a whole submit that power to that government. And you believe in that structure of society. It's like money. The most basic element of our modern society is money. Money has value because everyone in society as a whole buys into the common myth that money has value.
Right.
The minute we don't, it becomes valueless. So maybe that's what this movie is really saying, is that all of these organizing principles of society serve their purpose because we buy into it. Okay. I don't got anything more than that. I mean, I'm kind of running out of, I'm running into a wall, but it's something to think on and think about and set you down a path to an interesting day of internal examination. Just don't short circuit like the computer at the end.
I'm going to say this isn't your worst one. This is your worst deep meaning.
This makes sense.
Better than Armageddon.
Yep. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. This has been Scott's deep meaning the whole episode. So let's do I think that's pretty good. Let's rate it and run. How many runners would you give this?
I'll start.
I will. Okay. Go ahead.
Oh, well, Thomas, we spoke at the same time. You want to go first?
Sure. I'll go first this time. I'm going to give it 7 out of 10. It has a meaning. I mean, there's problems with it. It's janky. It doesn't make sense at times. But I did enjoy it. It was fascinating and did have quite a bit of meaning to it. And definitely makes you think. So overall, it's a good one. I give it probably 7.5, I say.
Okay. Scott?
I don't know why I like this movie, but I do. I do know why I like this movie, because it never stopped making me think. It's a flawed movie in a lot of ways. A lot of the plot is about nothing. I mean, there's a contrived plot here. There's a sanctuary that the escaped runners get to. There's 1,056 of them. We want to know where they are. It's potentially an insurgent threat to the city. There's an insurgent group, a submersive group that kind of hangs out in a tunnel system just outside the main mall of America that everyone's living in, because they don't go to sanctuary themselves, but they send you on the way. And then you know this whole thing about finding sanctuary, but it doesn't exist. And the 1,056 runners have just been turned into food by Box. And the computer is going to send out one of their sandmen, Logan, on a run and not tell anybody else that he's, you know, doing their work by leaving the city. Don't tell him why he's going. Just say, we've given Logan authorization to leave the city. But instead, you're going to send him off as a runner and hope that he gets through. There's a love story that exists just as a contrivance. There is no reason. It is the most ham-fisted, force two people together and say you love each other love story ever. There's nothing organic there. They love each other because the plot says they need to love each other. Love interest. Bam! There's a ton of things that aren't explained, don't make sense. Why does everybody love to go to Carousel? I guess that's just human bloodlust. Why does everybody turn around and destroy the city when they see that there's one old man? Oh, there's one old man. Let's give up everything we've ever believed in, because what's going on right now shows us that people will give up their beliefs in whatever they believed in just because they're shown that there's another possible way, or that their one way is completely wrong or factually wrong. But no, you know, there's one old man, so let's give up everything. There's a lot wrong with this movie. That said, I don't care about any of what's wrong with this movie, because it's constantly making me think. And even though I'm not sure that I understand everything that this movie's trying to tell me yet, I probably want to watch it 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 more times until I do. And for that reason, I'm going to get to where Thomas got to it with the 7.25 runners. You know, Box only got a leg for that last fish stick. I'll give it a 7.25 because there's a ton to think about. And it, you know, if it didn't have all of those flaws that I went through, it might be closer to a 9 or a 9.5. That's like Mark's 1-minute synopsis.
That's fine. I give it a 6 or 7 because it has those interesting sci-fi thing. It does what sci-fi is supposed to do. Good sci-fi. It addresses if it's not exploring the possibilities of science, it's making us examine ourselves. And that's what this does. But that being said, now I presume some of the objections that Scott brought up are addressed in the book. I presume. I don't know for sure, though. But that having been said, it was a good film. It didn't make me bored at any point. And the only problem I have with it is, aside from those plot points, that it's very dated. Because they went all in the 70s, and of course the sequel is Space Disco 1 or whatever.
That was made in 2007, though, I think.
What's that?
I think that was made in 2007. That's all I can find on it, but...
Well, sorry. But still, the fact that it's very dated shows that that's the kind of sci-fi that... It's one thing where you can accept the technology is outdated looking because they couldn't conceive of the technology that was coming. That's fine. But it's another thing to go whole hog on the culture and the appearance, knowing full well that's not going to stay that way. Or maybe it works, but just not with the 70s. So I don't know. But so I'll give it 6 or 7 for that. And as I said, if you sickies want to tell, if you know anything you'd like to tell about from a review, or maybe you read the book, you can leave us comments at
our website at ravinglunaticmedia.com, ravinglunaticmedia.com, ravinglunaticmedia.com. If you want to look up all of our defunct other social media pages that are still active, but we just don't use, you can go ahead and listen to past episodes, but ravinglunaticmedia.com.
We should probably reactivate those, but anyway.
Or start using them.
That's it.
What's left for them to do, Rage Master?
Stay sick, sickies.